Hey folks, welcome back to the Demystify Sci podcast. We are broadcasting from sunny Roswell, New Mexico today. As we continue, I believe we are in the fourth week of our tour. So last week we were in Austin. Obviously we had the Demystify Sci conference, the inaugural Demystify Sci conference, which was absolutely amazing. And now we have made it slightly westward and we're going to be in Santa Fe next. But Roswell gave us the opportunity to investigate UAPs, or at least sit down and have a conversation about the UAP situation, because it's very interesting to all of you. People that I talked to at the conference were really interested in the whole UAP discussion. And I have tried my best to find interest in it, and I have found a lot of interest in it. And I've tried really hard to convince myself of the anecdotal stories that I've read across the interwebs and across books, and we've pulled on some different writings from the past, right? So people have been examining UFO, UAP phenomena for a long time, most notably since the end of World War II, let's say, huge flying saucer craze in 47. And so we went back into the literature and tried to look at the historic analyses of these and attach them to what's happening in the world today. See if we can't make sense of it, because there's really only two possibilities. One is there's extraterrestrial intelligence, which is coming here and interfacing with us in various ways, and they have different motivations, which we can unpack. And the second possibility is that we really want there to be extraterrestrials who are coming and interacting with us and perhaps guiding us, or even perhaps punishing us for our sinister ways here on this planet. In particular, the way that we've been interfacing with our ecosystem since the industrial boom over the last few hundred years.
And either way you slice it, it's basically a sky god narrative. And that's a really interesting thing, because I think that we look out onto the world and we, on some level, have accepted that there is not a sky god, and yet it seems like that desire for one to be taken care of by an intelligence that is smarter than us, that is wiser than us, is constantly arising. And so I feel like it's really rich ground for exploring our relationship to the past, our relationship to the planet, our relationship to the future. And I remain skeptical of the phenomenon. I really do. I think that almost every single experience that people have can be explained away by something. And I find a lot of credulity inside of people's reporting. Like, there's not a lot of skepticism about, even in John Mack's book, there's this sense of taking it as a given that this is happening. And I'm like, okay, well, what are the surrounding circumstances that have led these people to have such uniform fantasies? So I think it's a fascinating phenomena, and we have a really good conversation for you about it. And I hope that you tell us in the comments what you think and whether or not we're way off base.
I'm really interested in the bigger question of whether humanity can get by without a sky god, without something bigger to orient ourselves towards. So I think that wraps into it as well. Anyways, I really hope that there are aliens, and I hope they do care for us, and I hope that they're going to guide us towards the solutions to all of our global crises. If you like this podcast, if you like what's going on, please come over to patreon.com and give us a couple bucks to shave a little bit off your paycheck, and it will power our project into new heights. It will mean the world to us. We have an incredible group of patrons right now. We get together every Sunday and hang out over Zoom and figure out what needs to be examined in the world next.
And in the meantime, enjoy the conversation, and we'll see you next time.
The scientific revolution starts now.
Let us see in the dark.
So Roswell's been a disappointment to me.
Really?
Yeah, I kind of expected there to just be widespread evidence of alien beings. I expected that we would be abducted.
Yeah, I was really disturbed to learn that Roswell isn't even the site of the UFO crash related to the Roswell incident. I was actually really stoked to come to Roswell because I thought it would be swimming with UAP, UFO culture. It is not.
I feel like I have the feeling of someone who's gone to go see the world's biggest ball of yarn because they saw a billboard on the freeway and is kind of disappointed by the ball of yarn, but is also like, well, what did you expect of the ball of yarn? I guess it's like, it's kind of kitschy. There's a UFO shaped McDonald's.
That's what I was going to say. Corporate America has really grabbed a hold of the phenomena.
Yeah. And I mean, it's so interesting to me because I think that one of the reasons that we came here is because we've been thinking a lot about UFO stuff in the background. It's always, it's definitely an attractor for anybody who has a podcast because it seems like it's a bottomless well of audience. And so there's always this push to be like, okay, well, maybe you can make some UFO content and then people will listen to your podcast more.
Do you feel the pull to do that? I feel more just people in our audience are very curious about UFOs and UAPs. And like, I was a huge X-Files fan as a kid, so I want to believe.
Yeah, more than anything. Absolutely. So I feel like a lot of the people in our audience are more or less convinced that they are already here. Like they're fascinated by Disclosure and stuff like that. But from talking to people like, I don't know, like Tim and Jeff and stuff, I feel like they're pretty certain that this is a done deal already.
And what has convinced them of that?
I have no idea.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know.
The one thing I hear all the time is that the confluence of reporting is too much to ignore. And I do think that there's something happening here. Like, there's a there with respect to the fact that thousands and thousands of people report seeing strange things, and maybe thousands report interactions or contact with extraterrestrial beings. I'm not saying that that's what's happening, but there's something happening.
You say that there's a there, but my first thought is, was there a there with McCarthyism?
I think there was a genuine reason for people to be terrified of communism and a spirit that was willing to support that. And if we go, we could go so many levels into that, because I think people need a common enemy in order to unite themselves. This seems to play out historically in all cultures, in all places.
That's true. However, the specific thing that I'm pointing to is McCarthy saying that, you know, here in my hand, I hold a list of 428 communists in the State Department. And at the end of the day, I don't think that they were able to prove the existence of a single one. And so it's taking the threat of something that's very real and then grinding it into the machine of political showmanship, of fear-mongering, of uncertainty and doubt and xenophobia, and creating something that isn't actually there for the purpose of being able to have this dog and pony show. And I can't get over the feeling that that's what's happening here.
And yet it expresses something deep inside of the people, right?
It's a very union of you.
Well, it just seems like even with McCarthyism, there's a spirit of paranoia about domination from outside. And people had just been through this incredibly traumatic period where all of their sons were getting sent across the sea to fight some nebulous super evil enemy. And now all of a sudden, with that resolve, there's a new nebulous super enemy. And I think there was genuine reason to fear the Soviet Union at the time.
Yeah. Just like atom bombs, or what do you think?
Just the way of life. I think the Soviet way of life is so antithetical to the American project. This idea that people would rise based on their merits is so absolutely counter to the Soviet program of everybody is equal and will be placed according to where they fit into this scientifically designed machine.
And it was even worse than that.
It's like a self-assembly aspect of America, I guess.
Yeah, and with communism, it was more about, as far as I can tell, your loyalty to the machine and like how loudly you were able to declare that you were loyal to it. And so that's even creepier than being scientifically placed, right? Because the only thing that system selects for is basically people saying as loudly as they can that they believe in something that maybe they don't actually believe in. And I feel like that's less popular here across the board. And so
maybe that reflects our origins as Protestant culture, right? If you think about the medieval church controlling the states across medieval Europe, and then essentially America being a refuge for people fleeing that very similar principle, right? That you have to declare loyalty to God through the church as loud as possible. And if you do, maybe the church will have mercy on you and connect you to the rest of the society. Because what's the church's biggest threat is that they'll cut you off socially.
Isn't that always the biggest threat? I suppose in the Soviet Union there was the threat of Gulag, but like beyond...
I guess they'll cut whole states off, right? They'll cut kingdoms off. You'll be removed. Like today, what do we do? We put sanctions on people and to globally pressure them.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very similar threat, right?
Yeah.
So where am I going with this? There's this spirit of rebellion to that in the early years of people escaping to America. It's definitely driven by this Protestant dream that we'll get away from somebody forcing us to scream that we believe in their particular ideology. And people think that they're going to set up new utopian lives over here in America. And like, to some extent they do. Like, you know, of course it's built on the backs of all sorts of brutality and slavery. And it's misery for a huge portion of the human beings at the time.
And I'm growing increasingly confident that most of the stuff that's being sold to people is poison.
Today?
Yeah.
Okay, so we jump forward 5,000 years.
America is older than I realized.
500 years, sorry. I believe the dog has something to say.
The dog is like, no, it's not poison. I love kibble.
Right,
thesis first, as you always tell me.
Well, the thesis is that there's a genuine spirit. I think what we're trying to do here is tie the overwhelming reaction to communism somehow to the modern UAP phenomenon, which isn't entirely clear yet, because nobody is obviously prosecuting people for UAP phenomena. Although there are some congressional hearings with respect to Congress being like, what the hell is going on? But nobody's being persecuted. There is a widespread boogeyman, which is the impending alien interaction, conquest, help. There's so many different flavors of what the aliens are doing here, right? They're either our savior or they're our conquerors. And so you were bringing up, or was it me who brought up the McCarthyism? It was you. Tie that to the UAP phenomenon for me.
I've just seen mass hysteria take people over. And there's this self-fulfilling function of mass hysteria where you are at center stage, people are listening to you, you're able to express all of these complex emotions on a large stage. You are maybe moving a machine forward that you feel is actually powered by you rather than you being just a subject of the machine. And so McCarthyism is that in terms of communism. It's a guy who basically latches onto the idea that he can start this witch hunt and becomes a superstar because of it for a short period of time, right? Like, there's always the fall from grace. And here it seems like it's kind of a similar thing, where there's a lot of people that are on the UAP circuit that are testifying in front of Congress, and I listen to them, and I just, every single time I listen to them, there's just some part of my brain that just, it shuts off in the way that it shuts off when somebody starts talking about, you know, like black holes and warped space-time. Like, it's a really, really similar experience for me. And
it's a really tasty, tantalizing idea. People will listen.
To some people, right? But for me, for some reason, like, my brain just goes like, mm-mm, mm-mm.
All right, well, okay, well, we're kind of, I feel like we're in a little bit of a freak minority with that. Because most people love black holes and warped space-time, and this is almost always what the kids in my first week of my astronomy class want to talk about.
Sure.
And likewise, people love UFOs, and they have,
sure.
I think we need to really uncover the roots of this want to believe.
But people also like Fritos. Like, I think that people just like tasty things.
Yeah, so we need to, I think we should try to understand what's so tasty about alien invaders.
So they're not necessarily invaders. I've been working my way through Mac's book, which I can't remember the name of right now, but he was a psychiatrist at one of the big universities, and he started doing hypnotic regression with people. and telling their stories. And of the experiencers that I've gotten through, which I think are the first three, they're all kind of like, these appear to be scientists or some kind of research team, and they're running a breeding program. And it's unclear if they're trying to replace the population of Earth or if they are producing the population of Earth. But the subtext of all of the experience is, we need to take care of the planet. It's a very ecological mindset, which has been surprising to me. Because these people all come home with the sense of, we have a responsibility to nature. And I'm like, that's wild. That's a really interesting conclusion to come to after apparently experiencing some kind of alien breeding program.
So I think that that's the hint of the appeal, is that some entity might come from the sky to slap us on the wrists for misbehaving and get us to focus on a bigger picture than our little interstate conflicts and see ourselves as part of something galactic. I mean, initially in Mac's day, it was solar system wide, right? They still had hopes that they would find beings on Mars and Venus. So it was very much this idea of just opening in the window of interaction. Wait a second.
I think it might not have been actually, though. Mac was in the 80s. And by the 80s, they'd already gone to Mars and realized that there wasn't anything there. I think that you're thinking about Jung's, because Jung was writing in like the 50s.
I'm thinking about just early, that when this whole, okay, so the flying saucer craze was in 1947. That was the first year that a civilian pilot reported having seen a flying saucer. And then there was 800 copycat cases in the following months.
Your dad also around that time reports having seen one.
My dad saw a UFO, a flying saucer, sorry. It turned out to be an actual U.S. Army Air Force, or whatever it's called, Army Air Corps flying disc. They were experimenting with a lot of these designs around the same time.
Yeah, he tells the story where he basically woke up one morning and he walked down to the dock on the Ohio River in Pomeroy, right? Pomeroy is the town?
Yeah, that's the closest big town, yeah. I mean, Middleport.
Middleport, that's right. And this thing came up the river, and it was a disc, and as the disc went past, the human pilot waved to him.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's a crazy story. And then later he says he went to, is it Andrews Air Force Base that's up there?
No, Wright-Patt.
Wright-Patterson. He was saying that he found some story about Wright-Patterson working on these flying disc things right after the war. And so I'm like, okay.
Yeah, they have a huge museum over there.
Okay, so clearly they were working on stuff that was similar to flying saucers. And so if the flying saucer craze starts right after World War II, then that checks out perfectly. Okay, the U.S. government is making stuff. It's convenient for them to have people believe that it is aliens and not their own technology.
Furthermore, in the next few years, this belief that we can actually explore the solar system, that we can become an interplanetary species, that we're going to go to the moon, kicks off. It becomes a very real and tantalizing possibility that, well, let's say it becomes almost an inevitability, the promise that we will become an interplanetary species. And so it's not that big of a leap of faith to assume that if there is an advanced species, you know, an advanced intelligent species somewhere out in the galaxy, that they too at some point will have progressed. And why should they be at the same phase of technological development as us? Some of them are certainly more advanced than us. So, you know, this is in the realm of science now, not in the realm of fantasy. You don't have to introduce these sky gods to come from down and slap us on the wrists and set everything straight in some sort of Armageddon. You just need this biological entity to be exploring other planets just like us. And so all the way up, I honestly think all the way up into the 60s, someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but we believed that there was a strong possibility of intelligent beings on Mars. They saw these canal systems. They saw the changing, the seasonal darkening, which they interpreted as greening of different parts of the surface of Mars. And I think that there was a very valid scientific hope that we would actually find other beings there, and that they would probably be kind of disappointed in the way we'd been behaving, nuking each other and so forth in the last few years. You know, a lot of the early UFO reports concern interactions with people working at the missile silos. And you can only imagine the mindset of somebody who's essentially sitting around helping pull the trigger on these devices that have the obvious potential to destroy civilization, perhaps life as we know it for human beings on the planet. Like the kind of anxiety that must well up in the subconscious for those individuals staffing those missile silos, right? And so I don't think that, you know, I think that in a previous era, if something had malfunctioned at the missile system, you know, some weird radar blip, they lost power, you know, technical shit happens. I think that they might have perceived it as an act of God, right? God came and was trying to warn us to stop this crazy nightmare. And that's why our electrical systems are getting messed up. That's why the radar is showing the hand of God on it. And since all of this space exploration, this talk of beings, this talk of us being part of a larger interplanetary conversation is becoming a real scientific possibility, I don't think that it's a huge leap of faith for people to interpret things in those lights. And by the way, I'm completely open to the idea that there were actually extraterrestrials who came down and turned off those nukes. All I'm saying is that if there weren't, it would still make a lot of sense.
Like, wouldn't it be a really convenient story if somebody, like, pulled some circuit breaker for everybody to be like, no, there were definitely things in the sky that came. And then at some point, it's just, you convince yourself of the fact that it happened because it's so, so necessary for known to be persecuted or prosecuted for it. And so it's just this thing that you begin to accept as having happened, and then it starts happening other places because there's this underground network of protesters that are basically deciding that no, there's no way that we're going to have nuclear Armageddon. Like, we're going to stop this. And the phenomenon, quote unquote, is just a convenient scapegoat that allows for these stories to kind of to start taking hold. I mean, it might also be that people, like Alyosha had a really interesting point. He was like, you know, I don't really buy the UAP phenomenon thing, but I do buy that there's the possibility of natural phenomena that we don't understand yet. And maybe there's some kind of weird natural phenomena around nuclear warheads that happens, that shows up on radar. And like, from everything that we understand about antennas, it doesn't seem too weird that if you had a warhead and ton of, you know, like a nuclear fuel pellet, that it might interact weirdly with radar.
And I think the drive to interpret them as somebody who's capable of relieving this tension, this anxiety. I mean, I think it's hard for us in this day and age to comprehend the anxiety of the fact that Russia might nuke us at any moment. There's literally bombers in the sky all day long, and we're just in school, and they're telling us to get underneath our desks if there's a nuclear attack. And we're just like, really? You know, I was reading last night, the superpowers, Russia, a lot of states in the Eastern Bloc, China under Beijing, they're building these underground cities.
Hmm.
Like they're investing incredible resources. Sorry, this is back during the nuclear terror, right? In the 60s. I mean, people were really planning on living out this apocalyptic dream underground. And I think it's hard for us to comprehend how traumatizing that is and to what effect trauma is capable of producing psychological innovations, let's say psychic levers to relieve that anxiety. I mean, people who are captured, who are being tortured and so forth, they often talk about dissociating. This is very common. They'll imagine some completely different universe that they're existing in. Even all of the stimuli in the room, they'll reappropriate to new sensations in that dream landscape. And we think, oh, well, you know, that's really extreme example because how many of us are actually going to be abducted and tortured in our lifetimes? Hopefully very few. But it seems like on balance, very few. So, oh, it's just an edge case. But I think that these anxieties in our lives do cause us to hallucinate in small little ways constantly or to dream ourselves into new situations constantly.
And this is kind of the Jungian center that we wanted to talk about, because we've been listening to Jung's book on UFOs and the phenomenon, and it's very dense. And perhaps I don't necessarily agree with everything that he has to say, because I think that he has a lot of super heavy symbolism. Like, he talks about the mandala a lot, and like the way that the mandala is representative of the UFO, and it's this like center of consciousness that's universal across people. And I'm like, I don't know, maybe. But I do think that he strikes at something that is relevant, which is that there is a central narrative that we all have that requires us to find someone who is outside of it, because the constraints of modern living are such that it's so fearful to be in these really dense environments that there's nothing that can be done except for just a psychological outpouring into some new dimension, which in this case is UAPs and UFOs.
Right, and I don't think that this idea that the world's just going to suddenly change and relieve people is unique to the UAP phenomena. I think you see it in fundamentalist religious sects as well. You see it in different cults, right? This kind of end times where shit gets straightened out, where people atone for their sins, the evil are punished, the righteous rise up, that there will be a discrete moment where things go back to or become proper for the first time ever, and all of our ills are ironed out, is such an appealing psychological idea. There's so much relief in that. I mean, if you could bring yourself to believe that help was on the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that everybody has this innate desire to be taken care of. I think that it lives inside of the heart of every single man, woman, and child. And when you're an adult and you're the one who's kind of striding through the world, and you bear a lot of responsibility, you start to realize that there's actually nobody who can take care of you. And the only entity that can is something that is superhuman, superordinate, super omnipotent. Which is why the aliens make sense to a, you know, godless cosmopolitan society.
I mean, I share this fantasy. I was talking with Solomon at the conference about how often I am staring at my cat and imagining what it must be like to have a super intelligent being taking care of her every need. And he's like, you'd feel trapped and it would suck after a while. I'm like, my cat goes outside. Like, my cat does her thing.
She hunts.
It seems pretty awesome. Like, I would at least like to try it for a day.
You'd like to go on vacation as a cat?
Right. And I think that that's perhaps inside of all of us a little bit. Right, we take care of animals, we take care of our land, of our lives. We're just working at ordering things all the time. How nice would it be to have somebody else come and order things for you? It's almost like being a child again, right? Mm. Like, I remember being 5, 6, 7 years old, and I remember not having to worry about paying rent, right? I remember not having
to
worry
about paying rent at a young age.
Like 9 or 10.
Working in the coal mine.
But I remember not having to worry about dinner, making dinner. I mean, how funny is that? Like, just making dinner, we do find a lot of joy in it sometimes, but it's also just, can you imagine some entity just coming and making you dinner? Some entity, you know, washing your clothes, some entity making sure that you had a roof over your head, that you went on vacation periodically, like all the things that our parents did for us in these, you know, suburban American landscapes when we were little kids. It's almost this regressive dream to return to that carefree existence. And I think that the more that people are alienated by modern society, and I know I'm kind of going out on a limb here because a lot of you are probably thinking that modern society is fine and you're not alienated by it.
Are there people like that? Sound off in the comments if there are people who are not alienated by modern society. I would love to talk to you.
Well, there's a techno-futurist wing of this
world. I think
world.
Even those people are alienated from society. Every single one of those people is building stuff, and they're horrified by what they're building, but also driven by the morbid curiosity of financial incentives and puzzle solving.
I don't know. I'm Michael Levin. Who else? People, I feel like there's a few people we've talked to recently who are like, no, we're going to totally engineer our way into this utopian future. Whatever problems crop up, we're going to solve them. Oh, just the Kurzweil conversation with those two. I was like, I didn't actually talk to Kurzweil, but I felt like I did. I listened to a podcast with him. There's this sense of being able to, that's the savior almost, that's the egg that's hatching that will be the sky god that will come from within.
Yeah, that's true. But they're still trying to make a sky god. And so they must be somehow disillusioned with the way that things are going right now because they want the sky god. And I'm like, if you have alien sky god or you have AI sky god, is it really different in spirit? It's still sky god. It's still somebody that takes the weight of making the decisions and the weight of responsibility for making sure that things go right off of you.
God, it's so interesting how often I encounter somebody, especially in these conversations at the conference, and people will say, well, I don't believe in God. Blah, blah, blah. I used to and blah, 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 blah. And I come to realize that they're talking about sky god.
Yeah.
So maybe we should be really careful about defining sky god. Because I think that half the population or more associates the word God with sky god. And there's some other fraction of the population that thinks of God as something more complex and nuanced, something more with respect to the sum total of the conscious actions of everything in existence.
So quantum God, sky God and quantum God.
No, I was thinking more on the level of action, reaction, instant karma, cycles of the universe.
I mean, it's
Don Hoffman.
It's tongue in cheek to call it quantum, to call it quantum God. But I just mean that it's like it's the interconnected fabric of the universe, God. That there's an emergence out of all of these connections, and out of all of these connections comes this action reaction.
Collective consciousness of the universe.
Collective God doesn't really have the same ring to it.
No, I know. I think Don Hoffman does a great job. From a scientific standpoint of putting a label on that, when he talks about when you get more than one person in a room, you actually create a new level of consciousness. Mm. There's new realizations, new languages, new things that appear. And if you sum up all of those over, you integrate them across all of the beings in existence, you end up with some meta consciousness.
Sure.
But that's not totally what we're talking about. We're talking about some entity which is much like the human equivalent of our cat, our super entity that's capable of pulling strings, adjusting things, sort of toys with humanity. This is the classic sky god.
And it's weird because the aliens are kind of like scientist sky gods, where I'm like surprised that they haven't replaced the breeding program of humans with some kind of simulated version of biology. Do you know what I mean by that?
Well, I think Jung points this out too. It's the rationalization. It's the attempt to bring the sky god into the domain of rationality. It's like we can no longer tolerate these mechanisticless explanations for things, right? Well, there's just a being you can't see who's pulling the strings and making your radar systems not work or causing this visual apparition for the civilian pilot or whoever's seeing these things, right? We can't just be like, oh, I really just think that in most of time past that people would see these things and just be like, oh, well, yeah, of course, those are angels or God or something. And that was perfectly palatable to them in a way that something about the post-Enlightenment universe is intolerant of such things. Everybody's so seduced by the idea that things can have rational mechanistic explanations to them that it's intolerable, and so the only place it can live is in some completely poorly understood natural phenomenon like super intelligent beings. And the fact that they have these hyper technological crafts too that are capable of doing things our crafts can't do, right? They can hover and zip around and defy inertia. It's like, well, that's kind of the final frontier for us too.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, we're kind of, one of the most depressing things for students that I find with respect to talking about the stars and the planets is when they realize how far away everything is.
Yeah,
and how
it's like
unlikely
this will remain in the realm of fantasy.
Yeah, it's like the only way they will ever be able to get to those stars is if we can actually learn how to manipulate gravity and inertia. And I don't know if that's possible or not, but the dream is real.
Technically, you can see religious texts as being a template for the way that humans should behave. Christianity is the one that seems most obvious to me, and that one almost seems like it's trying to tell you that you should behave like God. Because if Jesus is the Son of God and you have the Holy Trinity, then like the God, the Jesus and the Holy Ghost are all parts of the same deity, and so there's this template for the way that you should act.
This is kind of the Jordan Peterson approach.
Yeah, exactly.
I like it a lot, though. Yeah, sure. At least in so much as it makes for a better world, if people behave themselves better.
Right, and I think that it removes a lot of moral burden off of you if you're like, okay, well, I'm just going to do the thing that's right and just and graceful, as opposed to the thing that is driven by the lower angels of my nature. But you have a template. And these templates periodically change. The same way that math periodically changes in physics and allows you to have a new set of ideas, I feel like the template for human behavior also periodically changes. And we've been using this template for, you know, anywhere between 2,000 and 5,000 years. And so it makes sense that we're kind of seeking out a new one. And it seems like the UAP phenomenon is kind of a new moral technological template.
Mm.
That's starting to kind of take over. Because if I was to think,
like, the proper thing to do is to interfere with other planets and orient them towards a better way of life and give them genetic advances and things like this.
It kind of feels a little bit like that.
There's got to be people who feel that way subconsciously, especially at the edge of the technological revolution right now.
About that all kinds of interventions are good and wise. I think a lot of people feel that way. I mean, like, we know, we've talked to some wireheads on the podcast, like David Pierce, even Andres Emilson, where they're basically like, okay, so the best thing that we could do is genetically engineering suffering out of all animals so that the world is on balance much more blissful than it is today. And like, if that is not a massive planet-wide biological research program, I don't know what is. And how would you accomplish that without the kind of technological visions that people report about visiting aliens? Of these massive laboratories with these cases with developing fetuses in them and reproductive tissue being taken from humans and being melded with the reproductive tissue of the aliens. Like, it's very, very...
Gosh, it's interesting.
Endorsement. It's an endorsement of a scientific research program on an interplanetary scale.
Yeah, because what do you think we're going to do? Like, let's just play make-believe here for a second. Let's say Mars did have beings on it.
Mm.
And we, you know, have more or less made it to Mars. We obviously haven't put people on Mars. But...
intelligent beings or just beings?
Let's say they were sort of not quite as intelligent as us.
So they were basically like primates. Primates, but not, they didn't have cities, they didn't have internet, they didn't have TikTok. They're just kind of like hanging out in the jungles of Mars, eating bonbons.
Yeah. What do you think we're going to do with those primates?
We would...
Same thing we do with the primates right now, right? There's going to be some very innocuous chimp empire stuff, right? There's going to be the Jane Goodalls. There's going to be the observationalists. But you think they're not going to grab a couple of those primates and put them on the spaceship and stick needles in them and stuff?
Yeah, of course.
You've got to be out of your mind.
They're like, we're just taking a little blood sample. It's okay. It's not going to remember this.
Yeah.
It doesn't have the consciousness necessary to process what's happening.
We'll give them some propofol or whatever. They won't remember it. It's going to be fine. We'll put them back in their jungle afterwards. Like, that's, in that universe, that's going to happen. Now, whether or not humans ever make it to another world where there are even halfway intelligent beings is,
I think it's inevitable that we will.
Well, it seems that's what was appearing to people back in the 1950s. It felt inevitable. And I think it feels inevitable today too, because this exponential increase in technological ability and computing power seems to tend towards us being able to actually solve these otherwise intractable problems like gravity and inertia, and how do we make it to another star system? Okay, well, there was a little bit of a depression, I think, in the 70s and 80s where people were like, oh, damn, there doesn't seem to be anything else alive in this solar system. But it seems like people are kind of pushing through that now. You know, this exoplanetary search has a lot of optimism. They're like, we're going to find a planet that has something living on it, and we're going to go to it. And what are we going to do when we get there?
Start an interplanetary World War X.
Yeah, not even. We're just going to pluck up some little, you know, swampus apes or whatever and put them on the ship. Mess with them, maybe breed them. I don't know. It just seems like in order to do that, there needs to be the moral framework for that being the appropriate and right thing to do. And this mythology seems to reinforce that moral paradigm.
So the other interesting version of this is that the memories that people are reporting of abduction experiences are actually resurfaced memories of ancestral events that seeded humans on this planet. And I know that that's...
ancient aliens. That's part of this myth.
I guess so. I know that there's like multiple different types of aliens. Like I think that the Graylings and there's the Graylings, there's the Aryans, there's...
the Anunnaki.
Are they discrete from the...
I don't know what their physical makeup is. This is ancient history. I think it's fascinating how mainstream Ancient Aliens is. Like, that was a History Channel program. History Channel program.
Yeah, but the History Channel got eaten by its own craving for monetary success. This is what we started out talking about, which is that there's an enormous draw where you realize that this attracts people. And then you start making a ton of content about it. And at some point you have to be credulous because people don't want to be told that the ideas that they have are silly or somehow psychological.
Not only are they attracted to it, but it's attractive and not, it does not interfere with the techno-futurist dream, right? It's like, look, people are also fascinated by different varieties of conspiracy theory regarding all of our favorite subjects, you know? But there's something threatening about them. Like people, like the conspiracy theory that NASA lied to us and didn't, the moon landings didn't actually go as told, or that the pandemic wasn't as, you know, humanitarian of a project as it's told to be, or any of these things that I
place the pandemic and the moon landing on the same level of conspiracy.
Well, I'm just saying those things are not tolerated, right? We can't do a podcast about those subjects and expect for YouTube to play along with it. Worst case scenario, they'll get us in trouble. Best case scenario, they just won't show it to people. Aliens, they'll show that to people. Like that's
to some degree.
No, for sure. There's huge Ancient Aliens channels.
Okay, so there are, but I also know that there's, especially in the wake of Graham Hancock's last series, there was a lot of arguing about the fact that Ancient Aliens is a white supremacist fantasy. And I know that there's teams that are inside of these tech companies that are constantly updating the variety of things that are downregulated. And I feel like Ancient Aliens didn't have as much scrutiny as it does now. And so I wonder if it's possible to build an Ancient Aliens channel from scratch today, the way that it was 10 or 15 years ago, before it started to become really mainstream accepted that
I think the white supremacy thing is a trend. I think some version of this will persist. Like, I feel like, look, if we were to tell everybody all of our darkest thoughts about some recent event that was a global phenomenon, we'd be screwed. Like, we can't let those dreams out of our heads, out of our private conversations. There's no way for that to be platformed. You know, you're not going to get thrown off of YouTube for talking about ancient aliens. There's no universe where that happens. It's just not it's congruent.
And somebody make up.
I think that it's congruent with this morality that you're talking about, this idea that the right and proper thing to do is to accelerate our technology as much as possible, to go and help/study other beings throughout the cosmos and become, there's this Ouroboros, is that the word, where you're eating your own tail kind mm-hmm. of thing? There's this idea that's a long, ancient idea that's canonized in various mythologies that some humans believe that they can take over the godness, the mm-hmm. creation, right? That they can become the creator and become the one that's actually setting the stage for life across the universe. That's a really old, I hate to say it, but it's a very old Luciferian tale.
The Luciferians, yeah. I mean,
in the Miltonian sense.
Sure. And so, I mean, I think that wanting to be masters of our own destiny is what has led humans to become humans in the first place. And so it's hard for me to see it as a Luciferian endeavor because I'm like...
Oh, our destiny is very different than the destinies of the rest of the cosmos. Like this dream that we can, the experimenting and the genetic alteration of other beings, this fantasy, this goes beyond our own destiny. This takes on this caregiver aspect of humanity.
But I think that humanity has always had that. Like you said that earlier where you were like, we take care of things. We take care of the cat. We take care of the plants. We take care of the cows, the trees, the farms, the whatever.
Are we taking care of those racks of mice up in the vivariums?
I mean, On the most surface level, yes. Somebody comes around, they feed them, they clean the cages, they wean them.
Somebody comes around and sticks tumors in their brains.
Yeah, that's after the taking care of, but we're definitely taking care of them. And the argument done for sticking tumors in their brains or slicing their brains up is that we're doing it in service of taking care of nature because we will learn something from the necessary sacrifice that these mice have made. What I'm trying to say is that the phenomena of the aliens seems like what it is giving us is a template for being able to continue exactly as we are and we always have been into the future because this is what humans have done from time immemorial. The entire reason for our own existence is that we have decided that it is our role to be the gardeners of nature and that we just go around and we collect things and we're like, well, I'm going to change this and I'm going to make it into something new that works better for me. And we do. And instead of having, you know, teosinte, we have corn. Instead of having little pea-sized potatoes, we have Idaho spuds. Instead of having, you know, tiny little oryx, we have these gigantic longhorn cattle. It seems like this is what we do and what we've always done. And I talk to you about this all the time where I'm like, the foundational principle behind all of this is sex and reproduction. All of it, like plant breeding programs, animal breeding programs, this is what we do. And so, God, doesn't it make sense that we would encounter aliens that are just doing the same thing with us? And it's just breeding programs all the way down. And so here we go. Like, let's get on the program.
It does. It does make a lot of sense. And I think that I can feel the will for something bigger than me to take care of me in a very real everyday sense. And that's playing out inside of all of us. You know, I love that the slogan on the wall of Mulder's office in X-Files says, I want to believe. Because I do, definitely. I really want to have an alien land in my backyard while I'm here in Roswell and tell me everything's going to be okay. That would be really, really nice.
But then if the alien's like, okay, and so now I'm going to need a sperm sample.
You're going to take care of me?
I mean, as
you're gonna
much
make sure that,
as
you're going to stop
as,
the conflict in the Middle East? Are you going to, you know?
No. This is all part of the research program. Right? That's the thing. It's like, I think that it's a false sky god. Because if they really are like us in the way that they're just a version of ourselves coming back here, or if they're just performing the same rites that we have performed here on Earth, then they're not going to stop anything. It's all an experiment, and it all runs together, and the prime directive notion of no interference is really important here.
I never totally understood that. When I was watching, is it called Chimp Empire? Is it called Chimp something? Chimp Universe? There's this Netflix
Chimp
show,
Empire,
right,
yeah,
where they follow these chimps around. I was really horrified that they didn't intercede. Like, I can't imagine doing a documentary like that and seeing some chimp like eating another chimp and not distracting them or something. And I wonder all the time about that ethical mandate about non-interference.
Say more.
Well, that part doesn't really fit in with the sky god vision of UFOs. Like, the sky god, if we're really going to transfer the sky god of the old times onto the aliens that are coming and visiting us with these lights in the sky and these abductions, I don't see that sense of caring in the scientific dream of today of non-interference. And I'm skeptical of whether that... Look, all right, let's back this up. It kind of reminds me of the Ayn Rand essay we read from the MIT graduation speech, where Ayn Rand's kind of like, look, you scientists have been made into calculators. You've been completely defanged and deprived of your ability to take a moral stance on the experiments that you're doing. And I think there's this push, this dream of objectivity that supersedes everything else in science, which is really dangerous, actually. And I think Ayn's actually got a good point here. Like, I think she's a little nuts on a lot of other stuff, but this was a really, really good point. She's like, hey guys, wake up, take control of your experiments. You can't divorce the angle that you're coming at these studies from. So make it a good angle. And I worry that the more sinister dreams of the abductions and the manipulation of people's lives without actually improving them for the better, right? The idea that you would come and get some sperm samples but not solve the crisis in the Middle East, I think is not proper, actually. I would much rather believe in an alien culture that comes and stops the missile silos and stops the war in the Middle East but doesn't take the sperm samples. Or at least if they're going to take the sperm samples, they're going to do something in return. But I don't think that our science right now is of the mindset that it would do that. I think that it would adopt a non-interference policy. It would take the sperm samples without actually stopping the war, because that's what we do in these today with these observational studies in the wilderness with the chimp empire, right? It's, we wouldn't want to interfere. Even that guy, right? Remember that document? I think the documentary is made by the same guy. Is it made by the same guy who did the octopus?
No. Different guy? Different guy. That one was crazy.
That's what I'm saying, right? He's like best friends with this octopus and he won't help it out when it's about to get eaten by a shark because he's like, I can't interfere with nature.
Well, it's not that he can't interfere with nature. It's that he wouldn't have a movie if he interfered with nature.
He doesn't say that. He says,
I think that it's worth like not taking people at their word.
Well, the scientists also wouldn't have a study if they interfered with the chimps, right?
Yeah, and so I'm just like, all of these people are driven by the way that the system in which they operate requires them to act. And the guy who's making a movie about the chimps can't very well be like, okay, we're going to stop the exciting things from happening, because the movie wouldn't have the drama in it if he interfered. The same with the octopus guy and the same with the scientists. Like, you can't study nature by just, you know, getting into it and like just cranking things around and being like, I'm studying nature. Like, no, you're changing nature, and that's very different from studying it. And I think that there are people whose goal it is to change nature. And the breeding program, if there is one, or the fantasy of the breeding program, I think provides this improvement on a longer scale. Because what is the breeding program for, if not to create a better human?
And that belief that we know what a better human is on a genetic level without being able to actually be better humans on a metaphysical level is really terrifying to me.
I think that we're hoping that AI will tell us. I think we're hoping that we can, while we run down this slope faster than our feet can really carry us, I think that we're hoping that we stumble into the ingredients that make this functional. And the aliens, ideally, would know, right? Like, in the fantasy of the alien abduction, the aliens are well aware of what changes they're making and what effect that they will have. And so I think that they're basically in the same boat as we are on some level, which is that they have some technology that's available to them, but they don't know the outcome of the experiments, and so they have to experiment in order to produce something that might turn out better. And we don't know what the goal of the experimental program is, but based off of what's in Mac's book, it seems like it's this eco-consciousness of learn to take care of the Earth. And I'm like, wouldn't it be fascinating if it was an experiment like that? And let's say the indigenous peoples were the last ones that were actually capable of doing that. And then this like capitalism virus came through and it became the dominant paradigm. And now they're just frantically trying to get back to a different mindset that has since been extinct on Earth. But every time they do, it just gets taken over by this extractive mindset. Because any time that
the indigenous myth of peaceful harmony is just complete garbage.
I don't think that they were...
They're just incessant warring and brutal mayhem.
Sure, but I'm not talking about like intertribal warfare. I'm talking about the like relationship with nature, of having an obligation to nature, of having to offer sacrifice to nature, of having to not take so much that you disturb nature, of realizing that the individual animalistic spirits are on par with you and not below you, and that you have an obligation to them. So it's like the warring tribes is like neither here nor there in this specific case, because I'm like, I think that there is an eco-consciousness that is at the center of the abduction narrative. And that's a really interesting phenomenon to me, because I'm like, if I was running an experimental program and my goal was to secure an eco-consciousness in a species, how would I prevent the continuous recapture of the mind with this kind of capitalistic, materialistic success virus of just like accumulate as much as you can, extract as much as you can, make as much money as you can, that just perpetually pops up? Like, what if this is just like a cyclic thing? And, like, the virus pops up and it spreads through the population like wildfire. And then the entire globe goes down into this long period of empireless and civilizationlessness. And then the civilization, once the resources build back up again in the course of, you know, 100,000 years, then people come back and start to extract again because it's easy once more.
I mean, it seems to me like there's been a lot of good that's come from all of this too, right? People are living longer, healthier, more comfortably. Very few people are starving to death. War is at an all-time low in terms of people just being lined up in trenches and killed. And whether that'll persist or not is anybody's guess. But I feel like it would make sense that if a civilization had reached that level where they'd solved their basic needs, essentially, certainly not for everybody, but, you know, it's trending, that they would want to reconsider the quality of their lives at that point. And in some sense, the idea of being ecologically harmonious is a quality of life issue. There's something really anxious and unsettling about being crammed into concrete lockers together and having to deal with traffic and having to deal with comparing yourself to hundreds of people on the way to work.
Which is why it makes it so interesting that the heart of UFO lore is not New York City or Los Angeles, but is a place like Roswell, which is, I don't know, maybe 5 minutes across, maybe 2 miles across from the center point in each direction. And so I feel like a lot of the abduction stories come from people in these really rural areas where maybe they feel the interface of how fragile our relationship is to the land. Because if you think about it, this place is irrigated really heavily. And so if you look at a map, a satellite map, there's fields all over the place that are, I don't know what they're growing. I haven't looked yet. But so...
gin? They're like, I don't know. They're all called like gin companies.
Yeah, they're cotton. They're growing cotton gin. I thought so too. I was like, God, do you think they sell gin? And then I realized when I saw cotton, I was like, oh, that kind of gin.
It's like this, the ABC Gin Corporation.
Yeah, apparently West Texas.
But yeah, people in rural environments are perhaps the most paranoid about the encroachments of civilization. Like, they're terrified. They visit cities. Like, the people out in the country where we live, they're like, there's no way in hell I'd ever live in a city. But at the same time, their children see often no choice because they want to get connected to the world. They find it to be the place where you get ahead, where you have a chance of actually making something and integrating yourself into the universe.
But I actually see something different. I think you're right. I think that is definitely one feature of it. But I think that the other feature of it that I see is that the sightings and the experiences appear to concentrate in rural areas. And I'm trying to square that with the idea of the rising of ecological consciousness, which I tend to equivocate with the cities.
Yeah.
And so I'm like...
But because the cities are so oppressive and non-ecologically integrated, people in the country are, though.
I don't think that they are, is the case that I'm trying to make. I think that this place is a terrifying anomaly where water is being pumped out of desiccated ground.
Oh, Roswell? I was thinking more back in the Rogue Valley.
I mean, even the Rogue Valley is a little bit weird. It's like
things are on fire, the water is kind of sketchy.
Yeah, and like chemicals have been dumped all around you. And if you look at a map of, you know, where the water intakes are relative to where the hazardous waste sites are, they're like surprisingly close to each other. And so
I definitely feel that out in the desert, things feel very much on the edge, right?
Like,
if these pipes stopped working, we'd all be completely screwed.
Right, like nobody has a well, nobody has real access to the resources that they need to survive out here. And you go into the grocery store and it's not like it's selling things that are being locally raised. The fields are full of something that's getting exported to some distant location. And so I think that that's the real terror of living out here, where you realize just how thin the margins are, just how frail the system is, and just how poorly maintained it is. I think that's really the thing.
That might be why there's fewer UFO sightings out where we live, actually. Because I feel like people have this real sense of self-sufficiency out there. There's a lot of people I encounter who are like, I don't give a damn. The whole world goes to hell. We're going to be just fine. And like, whether they are or not is a different question, but there's definitely a sense among some significant portion of the population that to hell with civilization, I know what I'm doing. I know how to dress a deer. I know how to find water. I know how to do all these things.
And I think in places like the Rogue Valley, they would be okay because there's tons of water. There's tons of wilderness. I think that the population that's there probably would deplete the wilderness really, really quickly, but it seems plausible that people would
compared
do okay.
to this place for sure.
It's really the desert across the board, it's like West Texas, New Mexico, Arizona. These are places where it just seems like people are living inches from the edge. And the empire is so thinned out that it doesn't really have the resources to be able to support them fully. And so it opens the door to the sky god, to the
alien. The techno sky god, right? Actually, even if you think about the people in this town right now, how many of them actually understand how the electricity is getting to their walls or the water is getting into their pipes?
I feel like it's unfair to single out Roswell.
I don't understand. I'm not picking on them. I'm like, when I go to a town, I have no idea. Like, I don't understand the inner workings of that system. Like, I'll pass a water treatment plant.
That's one of the crazy things. We've talked to people all along the strip, people that are residents, and being like, so where do you guys get your water? And they're like,
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we concern ourselves with that when we go to a new town. But I'm just saying that there is this element of supernatural underworkings because it's so far from people's everyday understanding and concern. Right? It's like, well, it doesn't matter. Somebody's taking care of it. And that's almost that sky god. That's almost that techno sky god. It's like, well, there's huge... Actually, some of these small towns we've been through, some of the biggest buildings, or let's say the biggest compounds, seem to be the utility companies. Right? It's this whole Men in Black thing behind the curtain that's going on at all times. And yeah, people work for them and so forth, and they play their part in that. But it's such an enormous project. All of these different power grids being connected, the water supplies being, you know, shunted here and there depending on needs. And it's just such a meta phenomenon, this organization that's going on behind the scenes, that is just kind of taken for granted. It's like Mingus getting her cat food in the morning, right? I'm not like concerned with whether when I flip on the light first thing in the morning, whether it's going to come on or not. It would be an extraordinary bummer if it didn't. I would be surprised, right?
Yeah. And I mean, the same way that Mingus gets freaked out when her cat food doesn't come exactly when she wants. And so I think that there are after World War II, these cities started to empty out. And as they started to empty out, the feeling that the society and that the empire was not as strong as it once was, where the fabric of these isolated rural communities was starting to fray a little bit.
Rural desert communities, especially.
Well, so it's, I think that we should look more into this because I really wonder about the arc of the massive dam projects. Because I know that a lot of the dams were done in the 1930s. And so had confidence already started to fray by the 1950s? I don't know. I have no idea. And so I'm just trying to say is that the alien phenomena being associated largely with rural environments seems to be about some aspect of living out here that induces people to search for a sky god. And it's really interesting that the sky god appears to be a recapitulation of our own empire's tendencies, which is these massive breeding programs at scale and also a nascent ecological consciousness where people come back and they're like, now I see auras and I know that our job is to take care of the earth. And I'm like, that's interesting whether or not they're getting abducted. Because I think that it's reflecting some deep realization that people are having out here that is pretty unique. And it's crazy.
And by the way, who's their audience? Their audience is people in the cities, right? City people love UFO stories.
I think everybody, I think that that probably like transects all races, cultures, creeds, and locations.
Well, most people are in the city is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, that's true. But it's not that
increasingly, right? What is the proportion of the population in America that lives in cities?
I want to say it's close to 80.
Close to 80, right?
So, but does this count as a city? Because, I mean, like, it's gridded, it's on a municipal grid. If this counts as a city, then I'm like, yeah, definitely.
I don't know. I'd have to look into it. It's obviously you have to draw the line somewhere. But the point is people are inside of the city are eating up these stories from outside of the city, which makes a lot of sense. There's like some exoticism to it as well, where it's like, well, that would never happen here in Manhattan. But I could see it maybe in some place where there's only a few people, you know, aliens are trying to stay covert.
The like dark romantic underbelly of the plains.
The dark regions, yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyways, I want to believe, to quote Fox Mulder.
Should we go get a picture outside of the UFO McDonald's before we go?
As long as we don't get any McDonald's. Although I hear they have really good coffee. My grandma used to love McDonald's coffee. But yeah, let's hang it up. Where's the next place we're going to be recording from?
I think it might be Santa Fe.
I think so.
Or Taos. Further and deeper into the high desert we go.
All right, folks. Hope you enjoyed our musings. And please tell us what you think about all of this. Have you seen one? Are we getting it all wrong? Please convince me. See you guys next time.